Asatu, now give all your attention here to Brother Matthew as he's going to talk to us about the seven seals. Brother Matthew.
Good morning, brethren and sisters. I'd like to begin by giving granted where due, and I'd like to give three thanks. First one is to Sister Amy, who kindly put together the PowerPoint for me so that I could concentrate on this address. The second one is to Sister Esther, who a long time ago did this map in front of me for another address. It was so long ago she'd forgotten she did it. But hopefully it will help at least clarify the geographical aspects of this address. And the third thanks is rather an acknowledgement than a thanks, because Brother Thomas isn't amongst us to hear us say thanks. But as with the other brethren who stand up here, I'd like to say that nothing I've got to say up here is at all original, you'll be glad to know, and it's just a regurgitation and a summary of what we find in the second volume of Eureka. If anything, the purpose of this address is to try and simplify as best we can in a short time the seven seals, but also to whet the appetite so that people can go away and perhaps have a rejuvenated, earnest interest to take upon themselves a study of the Book of Revelation, which is quite a big task, but one which is something incumbent upon us all to do if we are interested in the times and the events and the occurrences of the things which are going to lead up to that grand day which we'll all look into, the day when our Lord and Master shall appear upon the earth and carry out all the law and the prophets, establishing that long-promised kingdom. But we must move apace. I'd like Ben, please. Ben kindly agreed to... he circulated them already. I should have known Ben would be ahead of the game there. Thanks, Brother Ben. So we've got a few mediums here, which are maybe at risk of confusing myself more than anything, but hopefully it should help everyone to maybe, as I'm going through, look at this and consolidate in your minds where we are as we're progressing through these seven seals. So if I start to lose you, hopefully you can just glance down, have a look at the structure there of the seven seals, and it will hopefully help you to follow along. So the seven seals, what are they about? The seven seals begin, the first four seals talk about four different horses. We're talking about a time that was to follow on from John. Brother David spoke this morning, I didn't note it down, but he said that the prophecy of those things coming to pass was to be shortly future to John. It was very near to John's day, and we remember that it was said to John that these things were sent and signified concerning things which were shortly to come to pass. And this is it. The seven sealed scroll opens. This is the first thing which John sees, was these four seals, seven seals, the first four of which were about four different horses. The four horsemen of the apocalypse have been carried into secular familiarity, and people think that the four horsemen were to do with the end of the world and that sort of thing. No, this was the first thing which John saw. It was, in a sense, bringing down the world at the time. It was to do with the destruction of paganism. That was what God accomplished through these seven seals. This was the grand scheme of the first seven seal, the end of pagan Rome. And pagan Rome was the persecutor, the dreadful, incorrigible, and unremitting, or very nearly unremitting, persecutor of the saints. There were, as Brother David mentioned this morning, some exceptions to the rule, people such as ironically, Commodus and Caracalla, tyrants, monsters of iniquity, yet who strangely and unexpectedly defended the Christians. But for the most part, this was a life and death struggle between Christianity and pagan Rome. The one was going to survive at the expense of the other. And the history of Rome is not a pleasant one. It's a history of power, struggles, ambition, immorality, bloodshed, wickedness, vice, superstition. And we come here face to face with the dreadful and terrible fourth beast. Brother Phil is going to give us some more details. But there we see the grinning iron teeth of Daniel's fourth beast. That fourth beast which was described as dreadful and terrible. And we see every shade and colour of sin in all its ugliness, in all its unpleasantness, its horribleness. And we're reminded of what Paul says in Romans 1. Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity. Those were the driving forces of the politics of the Roman world. That's the character of this fourth beast, the so-called civilized Rome, which has dominated the history of the past two millennia. But the seven seals are more than just a commentary on Rome. It's not just a history. It's a revelation to us of God's hand working in man's affairs on behalf of his servants. All things are for your sakes, Paul said. All things are for your sakes. So whereas there were all these important people, they've got statues that remain to this day in museums across the world, they've got their name in the history books, but this wasn't about them. It was about God's servants. We remember what Christ said about the impending disaster in AD 70. For the elect's sake, those days are shortened, he said, so that the coming of those Roman armies were brought forward for the sake of God's servants, showing again that it was God moving history for his purpose. So all these people which we might be talking about, the Vespasians, the Commoduses, the Caracallas, the Constantines, they don't matter. They played a part in the outworking of God's plan, and some of what they were doing, of course, was against God's plan. But there they are in the annals of history, and a very ugly history they paint. They, by contrast to them, we have God's servants, the brethren, as they're described in the book of Revelation, God's fellow servants and brethren. And it's these which are first brought to our attention. We didn't, in our introductory reading, we read from Revelation chapter 6. But if we look back to chapter 5, it's actually, chapter 4, where the four living ones are first represented. And it's fitting to remember these four living ones because they appear in the first four seals. We can't really comment on them. We just told about them in chapter 4 and chapter 5, and we can glance through them. But we know from the imagery given to us in chapter 4, the first beast or living one was like a lion, a calf, an eagle, and a man. This is the heraldry of the cherubim. What we're talking about here is God's cherubim, God manifest in his servants. Now the other personage in these seven seals is the Lamb. And it was the Lamb in the fifth chapter who was found worthy to open the book. The four living ones were the upstanding characters, the steadfast, faithful servants of God throughout the generations. But even they were not found worthy to open these seals. So it is the Lamb who opened the seals. And it's the Lamb, the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God without spot and blemish, who is the primary instrumentality in the bringing about the affairs of these seven seals. This is not pure history. It was not a the work of a Constantine to establish Christianity as the victor over paganism. It was the work of the Lamb. It wasn't just the pure wickedness and vice of some of these emperors who spilled bloodshed copiously throughout the empire. It was the work of the Lamb. It wasn't even the virtue and wisdom, as Gibbon describes it, in the case of those so-called good emperors, which gave peace to the Roman Empire at certain points, as we shall see. It was the work of the Lamb. The Lamb, the Lord Jesus Christ, was the primary agency in the events of the seals. And yet Gibbon, a great historian, will tell us that it was the folly and tyranny of different emperors, which precipitated the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Who put them there? Who put those wicked people, those monsters of iniquity, in those places of power? It was the Lamb. We remember that Jesus, when he was departing from his disciples, he said to them, "I go to prepare a place for you." Now, the preparation of that place for his disciples, that kingdom which he was going to prepare, involved the outworking of a great plan in the politics of mankind, as well as the collection of people here and there, his servants, a small number throughout the generations, just as we are here, only a handful of people, a very paltry few. But the preparation of that kingdom, "I go to prepare a place for you," was the work of the apocalypse, which we begin here with the seven seals. And we must press on, because I'm just in the introduction here, and we've got a lot to say and little time to say it. Just one final point in introduction. We remember that verse in Daniel: "The Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." And again, what Paul said in Romans: "The powers that be are ordained of God." So we can derive a lot of comfort here as we look at a blood-stained part of Earth's history, to see that God's hand was there, that it was the unfolding irrevocably of God's purpose, as seals are opened, as things are unveiled, as judgment falls on the guilty. God's hand, the hand, the outworking of that Lamb, was there. So when maybe we get a bit distressed at the politics of mankind, we've just got to remember the same thing. God sometimes moves through the wicked. And his plan is sometimes not obvious to us. But in due course, the wisdom of God's outworking of his plan will be revealed. Right, the four horses. What are the four horses? Romans claim to be the offspring of Mars, we read from Eureka, their god of war, whom they worshipped by horse races and horse sacrifices. So the horse is a good symbol for the population, the people of Rome, the kingdom at the time. You have in your handout the seven seals, and you can see the description there. This is just lifted straight from Eureka, but you can see what was symbolized by those different seals. But basically, the white horse was what came first. Astride the white horse was an arrowless bowman. The white horse just represented peace. Following the white horse, there was represented a period of bloodshed by a red horse. So the red horse symbolizes war. The black horse, which followed, symbolized lamentation, mourning, and woe. And the final horse, we read in the King James, I think the word is white, but the Greek word is chloros, which means pale, or a ghastly hue. So it's a sort of, if you can imagine, a greeny, pale color, which represents sickness, famine, and pestilence. So those are the four horses. So what do we find in the first seal? As we said, we find this. The first one we find is that white horse. The white symbolizes peace. And peace really is perhaps the most surprising of all those horses in that period, because peace and Rome are not something which really go well together. They were very good at shedding blood for sure, but keeping peace was not something they did very well. And yet, extraordinarily, to John it was said, this is what's going to happen. Chapter 6, verse 1, I saw the Lamb opened one of the seals, and the voice of thunder heralds the first phase of the first seal. And he sees this white horse, an arrowless bowman, and a crown is given to him. The voice of deity was thunder in the decree. Peace was to reign over the Roman earth. What God's servants didn't know was when this period of peace was going to end. John, when he was writing the Apocalypse, he'd been exiled to Patmos. He'd been submerged in boiling oil by the Emperor Domitian, who was a cruel persecutor of the Christians. So his attempt to kill John had failed, so he thought, well, let's exile him in Patmos. God had a plan with John. Revelation was going to be the closing book of the New Testament, and that had to be accomplished before he should expire. And this was round about AD 98-99. John was in Patmos. After this, shortly after Domitian, came Nerva. You see, in that list, you've got a list of emperors there. Nerva was an old senator, acclaimed for his goodness and virtue. And Nerva was actually good to the Christians, as well as good to all the Roman people. He repealed some of the cruel laws of Domitian and set John free, where John died shortly after, peacefully. And the Roman Empire was starting to feel the effects of what we would call good reign. Now, good reign is a relative sort of thing, because in this time of peace, don't expect that the Christians will have peace. The peace of the Roman horse is a different thing to the peace of God's servants, who are not the subjects of the Roman Empire, they're the subjects of God and his decrees. Following Nerva was Trajan, who you see there. That's a bust from the British Museum. Trajan was an avowed cruel persecutor of God's servants. But during Trajan's time, he expanded the borders of the Roman world to the outer limits by taking over Dacia, which was in mid-Europe. If you look on the map, sort of like, where are we? Somewhere in this sort of region, in the upper middle regions of Europe. This was where the region was extended to under the reign of Trajan. So extremely successful in the military, and yet at the same time, he was good to his Roman citizens, putting aside the Christians. Following him was Hadrian, as you can see. But first of all, let's have a look there at what Trajan was like as a character. He said, "I'm wearied with punishing and destroying the Galilean, or those of the sect called Christian, according to the Emperor Trajan's orders." Sorry, this is from Tiberianus of Syria, a letter to the Emperor Trajan. "Yet they never cease to profess voluntarily what they are, and to offer themselves to death. Wherefore I have laboured, but exhortation and threatening to discourage them from daring to confess to me that they are of that sect. Yet in defiance of all persecution, they still continue to do it. Be pleased, therefore, to inform me what your Highness thinks proper to be done with them." What we find in the character of these Christians here is that which is depicted by the rider astride the white horse. We saw upon that horse, in the vision, the first seal opened, and we saw upon that white horse a rider who had a bow, no arrow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. So this is a conqueror without any means of physical armoury, I suppose we could call it. He has a bow, but he has no means of inducing any mortal blow by natural means. So who is this rider? Well, we can ask ourselves the question, who was engaged in a battle at this time without carnal weapons? Let's turn the pages of our Bible to Ephesians 6. Verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armour of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the Diabolos. Who is the Diabolos? The Diabolos, the devil, we read of, the same person Paul's talking about here in the Ephesian epistle, we read of the same Diabolos in Revelation chapter 12. There in Revelation 12, he's described as a great red dragon. And again, this great red dragon is there depicted as a warring against the woman who symbolizes the Christians. So this was who Paul was saying they were fighting against. They were fighting against the wiles of the Diabolos. Okay, yes, we have the Diabolos within us, and yeah, it's good for us to apply that to ourselves. But it wasn't just that, because he was talking about wrestling against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. So this very much was a warfare. This wasn't just like it is for us. We can turn up here and we can talk to each other, we can enjoy the fraternity of this gathering. Christianity in these days of the first seven seals were involved in a life and death struggle, a wrestling against these principalities and powers, against this Diabolos, this great big red dragon of pagan Rome. What does the bow represent on this rider of the first horse? The bow is a symbol of words, and we can have a look in Psalm 64 verse 3 to see where it can be the use of words in a bad sense. Psalm 64 verse 3, who whet their tongue like a sword and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, even bitter words. And Isaiah 66 verse 19, for where it's used in a good sense of preaching the truth. Isaiah 66 verse 19, and I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, to Tubal and Javan, to the isles afar off, that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. So that use of the bow there shows that it can be used to refer to the word. Now the word is the only offensive weapon at the disposal of Christ's servants. They can't resort to carnal weapons, just like that arrowless bowman there. The only thing they can use in their warfare is the word. In Ephesians 5, that was depicted by the sword. All the armour which was depicted in Ephesians 5 was all defensive. The one offensive weapon was the sword of the Spirit. in a different sort of way this is presented here. I suppose if the sword had been given to this rider, it might have made us think that he was a militant sort of person upon this horse, whereas in reality the Christians in this first period were non-militant and peaceful. That changed, interestingly, very, very quickly. The devil did make some strides. The devil shall cast some of you into prison. Hadrian followed suit from Trajan and was quite persecuted of the Christians. But most of all was this man, Aurelius. This man, Gibbon describes as one of the greatest emperors of the Roman world. And he describes his reign as having invariable wisdom and virtue. He had forgotten the fact that whilst his reign over the Roman inhabitants was excellent, and the Roman people enjoyed peace at its climax, really, he'd forgotten that this was one of the worst persecutors of the Christians. In fact, Eusebius, or was it maybe Mosheim, one of the two, said that they believed this man to be the worst persecutor of the Christians besides for Nero. So he's pretty bad to the Christians. We remember in the letters to the Ecclesias, it said that the devil shall cast some of you into prison. So it wasn't said to them that they would get instant victory. It was to be a gradual process, but victory was to come. And it says, he went forth conquering and to conquer. A crown was given unto him. Now this wasn't a crown that a king wears, like the Queen of England, when she ascends the throne, she has a crown put on her head, which is the symbol of monarchy. This crown here in the Greek is Stephanos, and there's a big difference. This crown here was what was given to runners in the Olympic Games. It was a coronal wreath. So if someone ran the race in a race in the Olympics, they'd be given a coronal wreath, a Stephanos. That's what it is here. It wasn't a diadem, which is the word for a crown, a regal crown, a monarchical crown. This was only a coronal wreath indicating victory. Victory. What was the victory they were to gain? Well, there were two senses in which Christians were to expect victory. First of all, there's the victory which we are aiming for, like them. We're aiming for victory over the flesh. We're gaining for victory over the world. Victory against all the wiles of the devil in all their different forms. So that we, like Paul, in the day when Christ comes back, can say, I have fought a good fight. Henceforth, there awaiteth a crown of victory, a Stephanos of victory, which the Lord shall give to all them that love his appearing. That really was the motivating thing in the mind of these Christians, these early Christians. Later on, as we progress through the seals, as Christianity got corrupted, they started coveting the earthly crown. They started coveting the Roman world rather than that Stephanos, that glorious victory which will be rewarded with immortality. They started yearning for the corruptible crown instead of the incorruptible crown. There was another sense in which Christians were to expect victory. They were fighting against this Roman dragon, and they were to expect victory over Rome. Let's press on. That's what Gibbon has to say about this time. If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was the most happy and prosperous, he would without hesitation name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. This this historian renounced Christianity, and yet we can't get a better witness for the carrying out of deity's purpose than this secular historian. We couldn't choose any better words to summarize this first seal, this seal where there's a white horse going forth and the Roman citizens are in their most happy and prosperous time. But this Roman horse was guilty. We remember all the vices and wickedness of this Roman earth. Of course, whilst these people enjoyed peace, it doesn't mean that their subjects in the outskirts of the dominion enjoyed peace, nor does it mean that the Christians above all enjoyed peace. We remember that Nero had used the Christians as entertainment in the games. He'd used them against the beasts of the circus. He'd used them as lanterns and wrapped them in animal skins and things like that. This is what Rome had done to God's servants. It's believed that the Colosseum at Rome was built on the money they'd obtained from conquering Judea, sacking Jerusalem. So it was time. The decree was to come that they were going to taste blood. I heard the second living one say, verse 3, come and see. And they went out another horse that was red. Power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And it was given unto him a great sword. Now you'd think, on reading this in the English, you might think that a great sword is something like you would imagine a barbarian wielding. That's not it at all. It was great, not in the sense of its size. It was great because of the power which this sword exerted. It wasn't a big sword in size, it was big in the power that was at its disposal for killing and taking away peace from this empire. Just one other thing to note before we go into a bit more detail about the sword. It says power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. It's actually to take the peace from the earth. So what we're seeing here is that the decree has gone forth. The peace of the first seal is over. Rome can expect no more peace. They're going to taste blood, copious amounts of it, for all their cruel treatment of their citizens and particularly of God's servants, the Christians. The sword, as we said, was not big in size. It was actually what in the Greek is called a machaira. Little in Scott lexicon defines it like this. He says it was a large knife or dirk, a short sword or dagger, but still rather an assassin's than a soldier's weapon. This wasn't a soldier's weapon. It was an assassin's weapon. A small sword which you could imagine fitting into a garment secretly there, ready to use when it's unexpected. He that sheddeth blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Give them blood to drink. Tranquility is over. The wrath of the Lamb is now to be poured out upon a guilty populace, the populace which delighted in the spilling of blood in the circus, and who were avowed to the eradication of the name of Christianity. This man was the first man in the Roman world entrusted with the bearing of this great machaira. This man was the son of Marcus Aurelius, spoilt, and he was well used to the life of luxury. But he started off his reign in peace. He was maybe what you could call a bit of a blank sheet in a relative sort of way. He'd probably tasted many different perversions of the Roman world. He'd come to power at the age of 18 or 19, a young man with the whole world at his command. The Roman world rejoiced to see this man, this son of Marcus Aurelius, come into power, and they hoped to get the same sort of thing at his hands as they'd received from Marcus Aurelius. But the Lamb had decreed a change. The white horse was now to go a strong tinge of red. And this man was the man who changed things. What had happened? He was walking back into the Senate one day. He was walking along a corridor when he was met with a person wielding a machaira and coming towards him and saying, "The Senate sends you this." And he very narrowly escaped his death. He prevented the deed, and the machaira didn't end up in his heart. But what it did was inflame the latent passions of his heart. And this changed the character of Commodus irrevocably for the worse. He changed into a monster of iniquity. In the darkest parts of his reign, one of his many delights was to go into the circus and to fight against unarmed contestants, where he would slay them before all the people. Even the Roman people considered this degrading for their emperor to be stooping to this level. But his hands were stained with blood, in the words of Gibbon there, after this incident. Interestingly, the people, the Christians, the people of God, enjoyed some remission of the persecution which they'd endured at the hands of the Roman people. It wasn't just Commodus. You can see there on your sheet that Commodus reigned for a short while. Actually, I think he should belong to the second seal there. He's found his way into the first. He didn't reign for a long time, but for this period, he changed the course of Roman politics. What happened was that the Praetorians had been brought into Rome. They'd been brought into Rome, and they had now been able to witness all the vices, all the disgusting activities of the emperors. And familiarity bred contempt. The luxury and the idleness of Rome also corrupted these Praetorian peoples. And what happened was that they became conscious of the great power they had. They were a large, powerful force of people in the Roman capital with great amounts of weaponry and power at their hands. And so what they did, they decided that they were a bit distressed with what Commodus was doing. And they took it into their own hands to send a machaira into Commodus and to destroy him. He was actually strangled, but just to make sure no one does think he was stabbed. But how he died doesn't really matter or interest us. But Pertinax was to follow. They set Pertinax up in his stead as his successor. Pertinax was wise and virtuous. If they'd left him there, he could have reformed the things which Commodus had got wrong and maybe set things aright. But the decree had come that the second seal was to make the red horse bleed from every pore. So Pertinax didn't even manage to survive a year. I believe it was a matter of days before the Praetorian guards decided that they didn't like his reforms. They may have disliked Commodus, but they preferred the fact that he was willing to give them donatives, he was willing to pay them, and they decided that this Pertinax was not good enough. So in came another Machaira, out came Pertinax's head upon a pole. And the Praetorian guards go to the walls of the city and they announce that they're going to sell the Roman world to the highest bidder. A vain old man, Didius Julianus, arrives at the scene and he makes an offer. This is what Brother Thomas said. He said it was £200 to each Praetorian guard. I don't know how that would relate in modern money. It would mean a lot more with inflation. £200 in Brother Thomas's time was a lot of money, but it doesn't particularly matter. Although it would be interesting if I'd given the time to work out how much it was. Certainly, it was a big bribe and one which the Praetorians couldn't turn down. So they accepted him into the city, and Didius Julianus now takes the helm and realizes he's there in Rome without a friend, without accomplice. He's got there by money, and now he's amidst a bloodthirsty set of people, the Praetorians. And it makes us wonder why he would pay that much money for something which was so dangerous as the throne of Rome. But he did, sends the throne, and starts to realise that he's in a precarious position. As Gibbon describes it, it was hard to remain steady, but impossible to fall without instant destruction. The Roman people were disgusted at the fact that their empire had stooped to this level, that it was sold to the highest bidder. And the Praetorians, even though they were glad to have the money, they weren't impressed by this old vain man either, so they decided to kill him. So down comes the Machaira again and kills another of the Roman emperors. And now the Roman Empire was split between the probability of three people taking control. The one was Albinus, who was in Britain. He wasn't particularly interested in the throne. And the other was Niger. I'm not sure whether he was interested, but certainly Septimus Severus expedited his way towards Rome, shed the blood of all the people there who were standing in the defence of Didius Julianus, and killed Julianus himself, established himself as the emperor, and then proceeded to destroy anyone who he thought was going to be a threat. That at this time didn't amount to a lot of people. It was just a little bit of civil war, a little in a relative sense to what was what was to come. But he killed Albinus and he killed Niger. Here is that man, Septimus Severus. This was the final great Machaira of the Second Seal, again taken from the British Museum. And this man, actually, in the latter part of his life, did give a momentary peace of sorts to the Roman world. But what he had done was he had established the rot which was going to bring down the Roman Empire. Contemporaries of Severus, Gibbon says, in the enjoyment of the peace and the glory of his reign, forgave the cruelties by which it had been introduced. Posterity, however, he says, who experienced the fatal effects of his maxims and example, justly considered him as the principal author of the decline of the Roman Empire. We're in the Smyrnian state here, and it's good to track where we are as far as the Christians are concerned, whilst the Romans are all killing themselves with that great Machaira. Here's what we find from Eureka. Milner says concerning Justin Martyr, he says that this man, his priority was hoping to conciliate the affections of philosophers and allure them to Christianity, to draw gentlemen and persons of liberal education to pay attention to Christianity appears to have been his chief employment. So we're starting to see things slipping away here. Polycarp, or we don't actually find anything wrong with Polycarp, was one of those people whose character stands pretty impeccably in history. He did not precipitatively, whatever it is, give himself up to death, but waited till he was apprehended, as our Lord himself did, that we might imitate him. We do not approve of those who offer themselves to martyrdom, for we have not so learned Christ. So there we've got, I suppose, the two people there with Justin Martyr and Polycarp, but we're starting to find that the balance of the righteous people to the apostates goes in favour of the apostates as time moves on. We must, I would like to dwell on some of these things, but I must move on to the third seal. Things weren't going to get better. When he opened the third seal, verse 5 of chapter 6, I heard the third beast saying, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see, thou heard not the oil and the wine. The black horse, we're quite sure that the idea of black represents darkness, affliction. And if we look in Job chapter 30, this will be confirmed, Job 30 and verse 26. When I looked for good, then evil came unto me, and when I waited for light, then there came darkness. Verse 30, my skin is black upon me, and my bones are burned with heat. This is what was going to be the state of the Roman world in this time. What about the balance? The rider upon this horse held a balance in his hand. Balance is a symbol of justice. Job said, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. In that case, Job was appealing for an even balance. But there was nothing just and even about the balance holders of the third seal. Their balance holding was of vice and iniquity, just like in Hosea 12. Hosea 12 and verse 7. He is a merchant, the balances of deceit are in his hand. He loveth to oppress. So this is the balance which we see upon this third horse, a balance of deceit. It was a prophecy of extortion and heavy taxation. There was going to be some mitigation. It says, heard not the oil and the wine. There was going to be some mitigation, but for the most part, this was going to be a time of extortion, heavy taxation, and vice. Now, the measure in verse 6, we read of a measure of wheat for a penny and three measures of barley for a penny. A shenix, vine says, was as much as would support a person of moderate appetite for a day. And now we're finding that it's a penny. We remember in Matthew 20, verse 2, the denarius, that penny a day, the denarius, that Roman coin, was considered a man's payment. So what we're finding is, for whatever reason, the readers of this seal could expect heavy extortion, that they would be paying far above odds for their daily needs. So if you think about the fact you're being paid for a day, and all you're going to get is enough to support a moderate appetite for one person, you're starting to see that we're going to get problems in the Roman Empire, which is going to mean death to the populace. And what happened? Here was the man who introduced the third seal, Caracalla, the son of Septimus Severus. And what was this man like? Well, from his early days, he and his brother Gita had not got on. And it became very clear to his father and his mother, despite all their efforts to bring peace between the two brothers, that when it came to the point that they'd be determining who was to get the kingdom, it would be at the expense of the life of one of the brothers. Septimus Severus predicted that the weaker brother would fall prey to the hands of the more powerful one. So Caracalla decided he wanted the throne and attempted even to kill his father so he could expedite his route to the throne. This was this man who opened the third seal. Interestingly, he was kind to the Christians because he remembered a time when, in his younger days, one of his playmates had been beaten for being a Christian, and after that, he was put off all persecution of Christianity, and even his father, because he would have recognized his father as a persecutor of the Christians. Now, what this man is most memorable for is not just his tyranny, but the fact that he remembered a maxim of his father. Gibbon says, "The wise instructions of Severus never made any lasting impression upon the mind of his son, who, although not destitute of imagination and eloquence, was equally devoid of judgment and humanity. One dangerous maxim worthy of a tyrant was abused by Caracalla to secure the affections of the army and to esteem the rest of his subjects as of little moment." So what did he do? Instead of taxing at 1/20th, he decided to extort 1/10th. He spread the taxation laws of Rome to the rest of the world, or spread the taxation laws of the rest of the world to Rome, rather, so that he was maximizing his income, which he could spend on his lavish activities, on his iniquity, and to secure the affections of the army. He realized that these were his threat. The people on the street weren't the ones who were going to take his life. The ones who would do it were the Praetorians. We won't go into too much of the detail of this seal, except to say that this continued up until the time of Alexander Severus. Alexander Severus followed a man called Elagabalus. Brother Thomas described him, he said, "No more beastly sensualist could have been found in Sodom than this high priest of the sun. The public scenes displayed before the Roman people attest the inexorable infamy of his vices and surpassed that of any other age or country." So this was a bad time for the Roman people. That was Elagabalus, a really iniquitous sort of people, immoral in the extreme, and carried his immorality and sensuality into the public scenes of the Roman circus. That was this man. Well, following Elagabalus was Alexander Severus. His mother, Mamia, who was described by Eusebius as a good Christian, she was actually, as you would expect for someone in that sort of proximity to the throne, she was ambitious and cruel. But she was Christian, and the good effects of Christianity spread to her son. Her son was Alexander Severus, and one of his virtues was, "Do to others as you would have done to you." So this was fulfilling what we read there in chapter 6, verse 6, "See thou hurt not the oil and the wine." So Severus, you can see on the sheet, he was the last one in this seal, and didn't last particularly long. It wasn't a high life expectancy for the job as an emperor. And soon enough, he was himself assassinated by Maximin. But what about Christianity at the time? At the time, we start to see things degenerate, and Origen was someone who believed in using the writings of the Gentiles to help him understand the Bible better. Whereas Paul, we know, said that the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. It's just an example. We can only pick up bits and pieces here and there just to give ourselves an idea of what's going on in the world of Christianity at this time. And we finish this seal with the fatal mistake of Alexander Severus to try reforming the camp of the Praetorians. He did it at the expense of his life. And so we open the fourth seal. And there we have Maximin. Maximin was a man who was 8'6". He came to prominence in the, back in the time of Septimus Severus, we remember. He invited the emperor to send him the strongest guards he could find to see if he could defeat any of them, and consecutively they all fell at his hands in wrestling. Now, in this fourth seal, we read not of an assassin's dagger, a machaira, we read of what's called a romphia. So now we can get back in our heads this idea of a big old broadsword which would be swung by barbarians. In verse 8, he looked in the fourth seal, and behold, a pale horse, a ghastly hue upon this horse, sickly, in the dying throes of the Roman world, as it was under pagan Rome. This was the dying throes of this red dragon. His name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. Power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. So this man here bore not just the sword, but the not just the dagger, but the sword, the broadsword, the romphia. He was actually a Thracian. He was a barbarian savage by birth, and by of huge proportions, as we said, 8'6". He didn't rely so much on the assassin's dagger as outright combat. When he was a mere brute, and when he came to his activities, it wasn't a matter of a little bit of surreptitious slaying someone here and there. It was outright massacre. When he killed someone who he suspected of death, down went all who might have been friends or accomplices supposed of that person. Thousands and thousands were killed by this man. It was supposed that the reason for his cruelty was that he feared contempt, because he realized that he was a savage. He realized that compared to Alexander Severus, who'd been before him, he was a brute. He didn't want anyone to be aware of his original obscurity. Here's what Gibbon says. He says, "Those who had spurned, those who had protected the emperor, were all guilty of the same crime, the knowledge of his original obscurity." He said also that Magnus, a consular senator, was with 4,000 of his supposed accomplices given over to death and Hades. Now at the same time we read of the Goths and the Persians, the Alemanni, different people on the outskirts of the Roman Empire. If you look in Titus 1 verse 2, you might want to scribble it down. There we have reference to wild beasts. Wild beasts that are referred to in Revelation 6 verse 8 were those barbarian people on the outskirts of the empire. What happened? We can't go into all the details. But these people actually invaded the Roman Empire and in fact actually made their way to Rome. The Goths marched all their way into Rome, and what happened was that the Roman people tried to sue for peace and paid these Goths to go. The problem was that these Goths weren't really used to bribes, and it just meant to them, if they had this money, then there was obviously more there to get. So this time was filled with with invasions from different people. Valerian, who was one of the emperors during this time, you can see on your sheet, he was actually captured by the Persians. And until he died, he was used, he was a fairly old man, but he was used as a footstool for the Persian king to get up on his horse. And it was said that after he died, they skinned him and used his skin as a wall ornament, so that anyone coming from Rome could quake with fear when they realised what the Persians were prepared to do. And the same happened to Decius. Decius took his armies into a battle in the northern areas of Germany. So we're looking, the Danube would be around about this sort of area there. And he took his armies into that area, and he was actually lost. No one knew what happened to him, but certainly his body was gone, and the Goths won the battle. So these barbarian savages actually defeated this great nation of Rome. I can't read all that that section from Gibbon, but the part in italics are worth picking out. The animating health and vigour of the empire were fled. The horse was this pale green. It was dying. It just waited. A change in the whole structure of the empire for things to get back on course for the Roman world. Let's press on. Time is flying by. This is the Thyatiran state, the fourth seal. And we have reference you already to the human soul. Very interesting quote from Cyprian there about luxury and effeminacy, meretricious arts, fraud and deceit, all finding their way into Christianity, but must press on to the fifth seal. What happens in the fifth seal? In the fifth seal, we read, they cried with a loud voice from an altar, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? It was a cry from God's servants. How long? They knew that victory was to come to the rider of the white horse. But when was it going to come? How long? How long was it going to be? They were maybe worrying under the reign of this man who you see up there on the screen, that maybe Rome was going to get the victory instead of Christianity. This man, although originally not favourable to the Christians but tolerant of them, was driven by one of his comrades in the empire to persecution of the Christians. As a man, we don't really see him as thoroughly dislikable by comparison to some of the others. Last off, he stood down, he retired from the empire, and Maximin, who he had brought with him to share the reign of the empire, was trying to encourage him back to the throne. And he said, if you could see my cabbages, which I planted with my own hands in Milan, then you wouldn't soon try to sacrifice happiness for the power and luxury of the Roman Empire, something like that. So this was this man. And yet, for all that, you might think he was a good man. This was really a deliberate attempt in the time of the Roman emperors to destroy Christianity. A policy, not just an emperor who decides, well, let's kill Christians. They decided, they wanted to eradicate Christianity. And Galerius, who he had brought into government, was really the chief culprit there. Can't go into all the details. Must hurry. How long were they to suffer? The answer comes. White robes were given to them, a symbol of their glorification, but they were said that they should rest for a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. Brother Thomas translates it like this. They should repose for a short time while both their fellow servants and their brethren should be filled up who are about to be killed as well as they. So the answer comes, no, sorry, not peace yet. it will be a short time, then the judgment will come, which will give the final fatal blow to pagan Rome. It's interesting that we read that word, "Oh Lord," that word "Lord" there is despot. It's not a common one. It says, "How long, O despot, holy and true?" And this Diocletian set up a new form of government. As we said, he decided to split the kingdom between him and Maxentius, and then introduced Galerius and Constantius to the reign. So it was a quadripartite division of the Roman world, which wasn't to last too long. But who was the real despot? It's as though in Revelation here, it recognized that there was going to be this man in this fifth seal, but who was the despot? It wasn't really Diocletian. The one in control of all this was the Lamb. This was the despot, holy and true, who was soon about to judge and avenge their blood. Afraid that I must skip all this to the sixth seal. And in the sixth seal, we read of one of the three great earthquakes of the apocalypse. Verse 12, "I beheld when he opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood." And thus, we arrive at the time when Christianity was about to be enthroned as the state religion. So just as Diocletian had tried to abolish it, its champion here arrived in Constantine. Constantine was the son of Constantius, who reigned on the western area of the Roman Empire, which was this diocese here. And he was actually in York, Constantine, when his father died, and the servants of his father acclaimed him as emperor. It's a very long and complicated history, which, had I given more time to the seal, I could have considered, but unfortunately we can't now. But basically it was a lot of bloodshed, and if you look in the handout, probably that's the quickest way of getting a summary of that whole period. There's a brief chronology of the events surrounding the ascension of the man-child. And the times to pick out are 312 BC, AD 312 was when Constantine marched on Rome and defeated Maxentius in the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And the other one is in 324, when Constantine meets with Licinius, who was now Emperor of the East. And on that date, they fought the Battle of Adrianople, and Licinius surrendered, was soon after executed in Thessalonica. So that long history is basically the final struggle between so-called Christianity and the pagan Rome. So this was God's judgment upon a wicked, tyrannical Roman Empire. And it was not just that, it was a revolution which brought down in symbol the stars of heaven as a fig tree casteth her untimely fruits. Brother Thomas describes it like this. He says, "This is the first division of the apocalyptic scroll, a six-act tragedy resulting in the fall of paganism and the enthronement of the Laodicean apostasy, called by its devotees the Holy Catholic Church as the religion of the Roman state." So the wrath of the Lamb had been dispensed against the pagan oppressor of his ecclesia. The dragon had tried to destroy the Lamb, but the Lamb had conquered. Sad to say, the new Catholic adherents, basking in the sun of imperial honours, they'd become turncoats. They'd forgotten that their professed master had said before a Roman authority, "My kingdom is not of this world." They'd forgotten that he said, "He that taketh the sword shall perish with the sword." They'd forgotten that he had said, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him." But instead, having loved the world, they became the world, and thus the enemy of the true ecclesia of God. By contrast to these adherents of the new Catholic Christian apostasy, who had forgotten that what they were aiming for was a Stephanos, a coronal wreath, not a crown. By contrast to these, we read of the servants of God in Revelation 7, verse 13. "One of the elders answered and said unto me, What are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence come they? And I said, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, These are they which come out of great tribulation, have washed their robes, and have made them white in the blood of Ram, the Lamb. Therefore they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat." These people are the great men of stature of these 300 years which we've been considering in history. Not all those tyrants, those wicked emperors of Rome. These are the people, the servants sealed of God, who are the upstanding men towering in faith. Towering, I can say for sure, above myself in all that they did, in the fact that they were willing to stand up for what they believed was truth at risk of losing their life in the most painful of ways. And our hope is that we might join them, those people, in their glorification when they come out of great tribulation and having washed their clothes, serve God day and night. We've got a few more, can't dwell on some of these things here, but just want to finish with the message to the Laodicean Ecclesia, because this is the state which we're in now. We're in the seventh Ecclesia, the seventh seal we're moving on to, which is the Laodicean. This is what Christ said: "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will sup with him, and he with me." And that's, I think, a good way to finish, to remind ourselves what we must do to open the pages of our Bible and heed the lessons of the book of the Apocalypse, that we can stand with those great men, those great servants depicted in that rider of the first seal, who went forth to conquer against sin in all its forms.